company will be waiting to see me, Pamela said. Without thinking, Ben covered her hand with his own. Do stay, he said. If the stuff you've been eating is anything like the stodge from our cafeteria, then I can assure you that Mrs. Finch's pigeon pie will seem like manna from heaven. Pamela did not withdraw her hand. Instead, she smiled. After a build-up like that, how could I resist? Thank you, Mrs. Finch. She looked around at the well-worn oak furniture, highly polished for years by Mrs. Finch and by the housekeepers who came before her. Then her gaze moved from the view out of the window across the fields to where she glimpsed the shape of Farley rising above the trees, and she thought, "This is where I feel safe." Reverend Cresswell came up the path from the church just as Mrs. Finch was laying the table. A smile crossed his tired face.
"Well, this is a nice surprise, my boy. We had no idea you were coming."
"It was all very last minute," Ben said, going over to shake hands with his father. "Someone decided I was due for a few days' leave, so here I am."
"And Pamela, too."
He turned to smile at her, then examined her critically.
"Looking a bit peaky, my dear."
"It's night shifts. I can't seem to sleep during the daytime."
"Of course you can't, but a few days here will have you right as rain. Good food, country air. You can put the war aside for a few days. It's just as it always was out here."
"Apart from an army regiment living in my house," Pamela reminded him.
"And that body in your field?"
Mrs. Finch said as she put the pie on a trivet on the dining table.
"Body? In a field?" Pamela asked.
"A parachutist whose chute didn't open," Mrs. Finch said with great relish. "They say he was an awful mess."
"How terrible for him. Who was he?"
Mrs. Finch leaned closer.
"He was wearing an army uniform, but it's my belief he was one of them German spies. They say they're everywhere these days, even dressed up as nuns, if you can believe it."
"Mrs. Finch, what have I told you about gossip?" Reverend Cresswell said. "Remember the posters? Careless talk costs lives. We have no reason to believe this poor man was anything more than the victim of a training exercise gone wrong. I protested when they had him taken away. I'd like to have given him a decent burial."
Leaning forward to cut into the pie crust, he was clearly dismissing the matter. The rich aroma of herbs came out, and he nodded in satisfaction.
"Now that's what I call a proper meal. Give me your plate, young lady, and you'll have some real food for the first time in ages."
They ate until they were full. The flaky crust covered a succulent portion of young bird in rich herb gravy and was accompanied by cauliflower with a white sauce, then finished by stewed apples and custard.
"I really should be getting on home," Pamela stood up, "but I'm dying to see Jeremy. I don't suppose the family will mind much if I go over to Nethercote first. I didn't tell them exactly when I'd be arriving."
"And you said you'd come with me, Ben."
She looked at him appealingly.
"If you want me to."
He stood up also, placing his napkin on the table. "All right with you, Father, if I walk Pamma over to Nethercote."
"You don't have to ask my permission, my boy. You're a grown man now. If Pamela wants you with her when she goes to visit her young man, then by all means."
Ben reacted to the words, "her young man," as if they were a punch in the gut. He knew they were true, of course. They had always been true. But he'd always had hope, especially when Jeremy was reported missing. And now his job was to deliver Pamela back to his rival. He wondered if she realized, if she had any inkling of what he was feeling. They set off through the village. The one street there was almost devoid of life. A bell tinkled as a woman came out of Markham's general store and post office with a basket over her arm. She greeted them with a polite nod.
"Lady Pamela, Mr. Ben, pleasant weather for the time of year, isn't it?"
And went on her way, as if their sudden return was nothing out of the ordinary.
London and points beyond Sevenoaks were out of her sphere of experience and thus not of interest. From the school came the sound of children's voices chanting a times table. A farm cart came toward them with a load of manure. They hadn't spoken to each other since they left the vicarage. Now Pamela turned to him. "Nothing changes here, does it? It's just like it always was." "Except no young men," he said. She nodded. They left the village behind them, and the road narrowed to a lane with a riot of flowers growing from the banks. As they came to the impressive wrought-iron gates at the entrance to the Prescott's home, Nethercote, Pamela suddenly froze.
"I suppose it's all right to go in uninvited. Should we have telephoned first to let them know we were coming?"
"When did we ever need to wait for an invitation to Jeremy's house?" Ben had to laugh.
"But things are different now," she said, her forehead creased into a worried frown. "Jeremy's home from a prison camp. He may not want to see us."
Ben took a deep breath. "It's my belief that he's been dreaming about seeing you again since the day he took off in that plane," he said. She flashed him a nervous smile. "And if we are told that he's not up to visitors, then we go away."
"Ben, I'm so glad you're here," she said. "I would have flunked it and run off like a frightened rabbit."
"You're never like a frightened rabbit, Pamma. You're the strongest of any of us. Come on, let's go and surprise Jeremy."
They passed through the gateway and walked up the broad gravel drive. The elegant Georgian house stood ahead of them, red brick with white trim, perfectly proportioned, with formal gardens on either side of the drive. The beds were a mass of tulips, wisteria hung from trellises. The lawns were perfectly manicured. It was clear that gardeners were still at work here, war or no war. As they approached the house, they saw an old bicycle standing beside the front steps, looking out of place in the otherwise perfect scene. Ben was about to comment on it when the front door opened and Lady Diana Sutton came out.
"Of course I will. Thanks awfully. Bye," she called, waving to an invisible person inside as she ran down the steps.
Then she saw Pamela and Ben.
"Hello, you two. What a surprise." "What are you doing here, Dido?" Pamela asked in a clipped voice.
"Well, that's what I call a warm welcome," Dido said.
"How about it's lovely to see you again after so long, dear sister?"
"Well, of course I'm pleased to see you."
Pamela still sounded flustered. "It's just that... if you must know, I've been representing the family and visiting Jeremy to cheer him up."
She picked up the bicycle.
"Somebody had to."
Then she rode off without another word, her tires scrunching on the gravel.
Part 3. Margot. Chapter 11. Paris, May 1941. She had not realized before that fear had a smell. She had always been told that dogs can smell fear, but she'd never heard it said of humans. Yet she identified it now, sweet and palpable, as she sat on the chair in a dark room. She was not sure whether the fear was coming from her own paws or was part of the building, oozing from the walls where so many people had felt terror and desperation. She had been blindfolded in the car that brought her here, but she did not need to be told where she was. She was in Gestapo headquarters, and they were leaving her alone in the darkness to break her spirit. Lady Margot Sutton sat on the upright wooden chair, not moving, staring out into blackness. She had no idea how long she had been sitting there, or whether it was light outside yet. Clearly, the room had no window, because even with blackout curtains, there were always chinks of light. They had come for her in the middle of the night, two men who said nothing more than, "You must come with us, please," in English. Her upbringing had kicked in.
"What do you mean? Why would I come with you?
"I'll do no such thing. It's the middle of the night, and I was asleep."
Then one of them said,
"You will come with us now, Fräulein. We will give you 1 minute to put some clothes on."
He eyed her lacy robe with distaste. It was the word Fräulein that did it. They were not in uniform, but they were Germans. That could only mean one thing, Gestapo. And one did not resist the Gestapo. All the same, she was not going to let them see she was afraid. Her aristocratic English background was her one trump card at the moment. The Germans respected the English aristocracy, having given up their own.
"This is most irregular," she said, her voice becoming an imitation of Queen Victoria, not amused. "On whose authority are you here? What can you possibly want with me?"
"We must obey orders, Fräulein," he said. "You will find out soon enough who wishes to speak to you."
"I am not Fräulein," she said. "I am Lady Margaret Sutton, daughter of Lord Westerham."
"We know very well who you are."
The man's face was expressionless.
"1 minute, Lady Margaret, or we will be forced to take you wearing your night clothes."
She fled back into her bedroom, mind racing. What should she take with her? The pistol Gaston had given her? No, her best chance was to convey innocence and indignation. "After all, I am innocent," she told herself. "I know nothing. I can tell them nothing." Thus reassured, she grabbed a black suit that had come from the house of Armand and put on a white blouse and pearls. She was not going to let those bastards see that she was in any way afraid of them. Then the thought crossed her mind. What if Gaston comes back to the flat and I'm not here? How could she let him know where she was?
"Lady Margaret!"
a voice called outside her door.
"I'm just brushing my hair," she called back. "Do I need to take a toothbrush with me, or will I be returning home immediately?"
"I suspect that's up to you," the voice said.
As she ran lipstick over her lips, she noticed Madame Armand's card lying on her dressing table. She took the lipstick, printed, "Call her," on the back, and left it lying there. Gaston was quick on the uptake, and Armand knew everybody in Paris. She'd know how to find a missing Englishwoman.
"If I'm still alive by then," Margot thought.
It was cold and damp in that dark space where they had put her, and she felt an urgent need to pee, but she willed herself not to. Rumour had it that certain royal persons trained their bodies to go without bathrooms all day when on tours abroad. She thought she detected a shout in the distance. Or was it a cry? She couldn't tell if it came from outside the building or inside. She stiffened when she heard footsteps coming closer, heavy footsteps of booted feet. They came very close, then passed, and she let out a small sigh of relief as they receded in the distance. She turned her mind to other things. Farley in the summer. Tennis on the lawn. Strawberries and cream. Pa, red-faced and wearing that ridiculous white floppy hat. Ma, always looking cool and composed, no matter what her brood was doing.
"Farley," she whispered, "I want to go home."
She jumped as a door opened, letting in a beam of light. A man came in, a tall man wearing a German officer's uniform. He turned on a switch with a click, and Margot blinked in the sudden light. For the first time, she saw she was in a featureless room, about 10 by 8 feet. In the corner was a bucket she could have used, had she known it was there. The officer pulled up a second chair and sat facing her.
"Lady Margaret, I must apologize for the rough and implied way you were brought here. I'm afraid my order to bring in someone for questioning is sometimes misinterpreted. Would you like some coffee?"
Coffee was something rarely seen now in Paris. She heard herself saying, "Yes, please, that would be very nice,"
before she had time to consider whether she should remain aloof and defiant.
"Maybe I'm reading too much into this," she thought. "Maybe they just want to ask me some small question about why I'm still here."
Coffee was brought, with cream and sugar. It seemed she had never tasted anything so delicious.
"Thank you," she said. "You're very kind."
The officer nodded.
"My name is Dinkslager, Baron von Dinkslager. So you see, we are social equals. We just need to ask you a few questions, then you can return home."
His English was excellent, with only the slightest trace of accent, and he was extremely handsome, having an almost matinee idol bone structure and the arrogance of a German officer.
"You are Lady Margaret Sutton, daughter of Lord Westerham. Is that correct?"
"That is correct."
"And would you tell us why you are still in Paris? Why did you not go home before the occupation, when you could?"
"I was studying fashion design with Madame Armand," she said. "I suppose I was naive, but I thought that life in Paris would be allowed to go on as usual."
"But it is," he said.
"Hardly. Nobody has enough to eat. We haven't seen coffee like this in months."
"Blame your English bombers for that, and the resistance. If they destroy supply lines, then it is not our fault. The Parisians don't have enough to eat."
He crossed his legs. He was wearing high black boots, perfectly polished.
"So fashion design was the only reason you decided to stay?"
"No," she admitted, seeing no reason to lie. "I fell in love with a Frenchman."
"The Count de Varennes, a fellow aristocrat," he said.
She nodded.
"That's right."
"And where is the Count de Varennes now?"
"I don't know. I haven't seen him for months."
"When was the last time you saw him?"
"Just after Christmas. He told me he had to leave Paris."
"Did he say why?"
"I understood he had properties in the south of France that needed attending to, although his grandmother at the chateau was growing increasingly frail, and he wanted to see if he could do anything to help her."
"His grandmother?" A smile crossed his lips. "You are either very naive or a very good liar, Lady Margaret. His grandmother has been dead for 5 years."
"Then I'm obviously very naive," she replied.
"Our nanny washed out our mouths with soap, if we ever told a lie. The threat of the soap has stuck."
"Did it not cross your mind that your lover might be working for the resistance?"
"Yes, it did cross my mind," she said defiantly. "But Gaston would tell me nothing. He said it was better that way. Then, if I was ever questioned, I could truthfully say that I knew nothing."
"And you have not seen him since Christmas?"
"No."
"Would it surprise you, then, to know that he has been in Paris several times since then?"
Margot fought to keep her expression neutral.
"Yes, it would surprise me.
Perhaps he did not wish to put me at risk. He is a very considerate man." "Or perhaps he had found a new love."
The slightest of smirks crossed Dinkslager's lips.
"Perhaps he has. He is also a very attractive man."
"And if he has found a new love?"
"Then I suppose I'd have to get on with my life, go back to my fashion design, and learn to live without him."
He chuckled now.
"I admire the British, Lady Margaret. A French girl who loses her lover would weep and beat her breast."
"Then we should be glad I'm not French. So much easier to deal with." He was still smiling.
"I like you, Lady Margaret. I like your spirit. I am also from a noble family. We understand each other well."
"Then you will understand that I'm speaking the truth when I say I have nothing to tell you. I lead a simple life in Paris. I go to the workshop. I do what Madame Armand tells me. I go back to my small apartment in the 9th. I eat a simple supper and go to bed."
You would no doubt like to go home to England now, given the chance.
She hesitated.
Of course I'd like to go home, you idiot, she wanted to shout, but instead she said,
I understand life in England is no more pleasant than life in Paris at present, what with constant bombings and the threat of an imminent invasion.
He uncrossed his legs, tilting the wooden chair backward as he looked at her.
You have not heard from Gaston de Varenne for months, is that correct?
It is.
So it would surprise you to learn that we have him in our custody at this moment.
This really did jar her composure. He saw it in her eyes, the sudden flicker of apprehension before she said,
Yes, it does surprise me.
And alarm you?
Of course it alarms me.
Her voice took on a sudden sharp edge.
Herr Baron, I love Gaston de Varenne, whether he still loves me or not.
And you approve of his work with the resistance?
As I told you, I had no idea he was with the resistance until now. But he is a Frenchman. I can understand his desire to drive out invaders of his country. If the Germans invaded Britain, I'd expect my family to do the same.
He let the chair legs fall with a sudden clatter as he leaned closer to her.
Gaston de Varenne is proving to be very stubborn, Lady Margaret. You can understand that his life is not worth that.
He snapped his fingers, and the sound echoed surprisingly loud in the confined space.
Unless he tells us what he knows.
You want me to persuade him to talk?
That is ridiculous, Baron. I am flattered that you think I have that great a hold over him, but I can assure you I don't.
You do realize, my lady, that if I snap my fingers right now, you will be dragged down the stairs to a room much less pleasant than this one, and down there you would be made to tell us every single little detail of your life.
Again, she forced her face to remain composed.
I have heard about such things, but I really do assure you, Baron von Dinkslager, that I have nothing to tell that you would find remotely interesting.
Trust me, Lady Margaret, if you are taken to such a room, you would wish you had something to tell. You would invent things to tell us. You would betray your lover, your mother, anything to get out of there alive.
Margot stared at him coldly.
If you are going to kill me, then please, do it now and get it over with. I see you wear a revolver. Shoot me now.
I have no wish to shoot you. You are much more valuable to me alive than dead. But I am surprised. Would you let your lover go to his death without fighting for him? Truly the British are so cold.
I assure you I am not cold, and I don't want Gaston to die. But I rather suspect that nothing I can say will make you change your minds.
Then suddenly it dawned on her.
I understand now. You don't think I can tell you anything important. I'm the bait, aren't I? You're going to use me to make him talk.
I suppose it depends on how precious you are to him, and whether he puts you before his country. We shall have to wait and see, shan't we?
He broke off and looked up in surprise. Outside the door came raised voices, one of them female. Dinkslager had just stood up when the door burst open and Gigi Armand stormed in. She wore a black fur draped carelessly around her shoulders, and her face was perfectly made up. Even if Margot hadn't known her, there would be no mistaking who she was.
"What is this?" the German officer demanded in French. "Who let you in here?"
"My poor petite,"
she said, completely ignoring him and going over to give Margot a kiss on both cheeks.
"What were they thinking, bringing you to a place like this?
You should be ashamed of yourself, Baron, for intimidating an innocent child like this. A young British aristocrat, no less, who leads a perfectly blameless life, slaving away for me, making dresses. I am Madame Armand, in case you are the one person in Paris who does not recognize me. I assure you that the highest-ranking officers in your German army know me well and allow me to live at the Ritz. Madame Armand, he said, I am well aware who you are. This innocent young lady is the mistress of a leader in the resistance. We have taken him prisoner, but he refuses to cooperate. We are hoping this young lady can make him see sense. I can see her point of view, Armand said, putting a protective arm around Margot's shoulder. If he talks, you'll kill him anyway, will you not? And if he talks and you don't kill him, his fellows in the resistance will kill him for you. We could come to some sort of agreement, madame. You see, this young lady might prove more valuable to us than a captured resistance fighter.
In what way?
He turned back to Margot. She moves in the highest circles in England. Your family knows the Churchills, I think, and the Duke of Westminster, and any number of members of the House of Lords.
Yes, my family does, but I don't see...
I'm going to make you a proposition. I'll free the Count de Varennes if you agree to do us a small favour. She stared at him suspiciously.
What kind of favour?
And what guarantee do I have that he'll be released, that he's not already dead? You have no guarantee. He paused, spreading his hands in a gesture of futility, then added, But you have a chance to save him, better than knowing 100% that he will die a painful death and that you might follow suit.
Don't speak to her in that way, Madame Armand said.
I am taking her with me right now. She shall stay at the Ritz with me, under my protection. And I will go straight to your top-ranking generals to protest the way she has been treated.
Dinkslager shrugged.
You are a pragmatist, madame. Of this we have heard. Take her with you, then. I hold you responsible for her. But make her see sense. If she agrees to do a small favour for us, I will personally guarantee that she gets home to England. He turned to Margot. You may go, for the moment, but we will have another little chat in a day or so. Think about what I have proposed, but don't think for too long. I cannot keep Varennes alive indefinitely, nor can I keep you at liberty. Please do not think of doing anything foolish like trying to leave Paris. You will be watched. And thank Madame for intervening on your behalf.
Stiff from sitting for so long, Margot stood up and was ushered by her employer from the room. As she reached the door, Madame Armand turned to look back at the German officer, and they exchanged a smile.
Chapter 12. Nethercote, Elmsley, Kent, May 1941. Jeremy was sitting on a chaise in the conservatory, propped up on pillows, a white chenille rug over his knees. The conservatory was at the back of the house, a glass-domed addition to the morning room with white wicker furniture and tropical plants. There were orchids everywhere, and the sweet scent of jasmine hung in the air. The windows looked out on the lawn with the tennis court beyond it. White clouds moved across the sky, sending shadows over the manicured grass. An arched arbour was covered in early roses, and roses also climbed the brick wall that hid the kitchen garden. Jeremy turned at the sound of footsteps. His face lit up as they came toward him.
"My God! My two favourite people! How splendid!"
"You're looking wonderful, Jeremy," Pamela said.
In truth, he looked pale and awfully thin. He was wearing an open-necked white shirt or pyjama jacket. With his hollow cheeks and dark curls on that sea of whiteness, he looked as if he ought to be a romantic poet, Lord Byron on his deathbed, perhaps. Pamela crossed the tiled floor to him.
"I couldn't believe it when they told me you'd come home. It's like a miracle."
"Don't go all dramatic on me, Pamma," he said. "Come and give me a kiss."
Ben hung back while she leaned over Jeremy and kissed his forehead.
"I'd expect something less chaste than that," Jeremy said, laughing. "But not with Ben watching. How are you, old man? It's good to see you."
He held out his hand, and Ben shook it. Jeremy's eyes shone with genuine warmth as he grasped his friend's hand.
"Welcome home, old chap," Ben said. "And I must agree with Pamma. It's a miracle that you're here."
"Actually, it was quite miraculous when you think of it," Jeremy said. "I certainly beat all the odds."
"Do tell us all the details," Pamma said. "I only know what I read in the newspaper."
"Not much more to tell, really."
Jeremy looked a trifle embarrassed.
"We planned a breakout from the damned Stalag. Someone must have ratted on us because they were waiting for us in the woods at the end of the tunnel. They opened fire and mowed us all down."
"Golly!"
Pamela exchanged a look with Ben.
"Were you shot, too?"
"I was lucky. The shot went through my shoulder. I flung myself into the river and lay there as if I was dead. I let the current take me. Then I hid under some rushes on the bank. I heard them go away, laughing. Then I swam and drifted for as long as I could. I found a piece of driftwood and let that carry me along for a while. Then my stream joined a river in an area where boats were moored. I managed to haul myself on board a low barge, one of a string of barges going upstream in the dead of night. And can you believe my luck? It was carrying vegetables. I hid myself among the cabbages. It would have been brilliant, but the wound in my shoulder had become infected. I think I was half delirious most of the time."
"You poor thing."
Pamela touched his shoulder gently.
"It wasn't too much fun, I can tell you. We went upstream for a couple of days. Then I heard someone speaking French. I decided we were either in France or Belgium. Either way, it was better than Germany. So I made my exit in the middle of the night and struck out westward. Couple of narrow escapes, but eventually my luck held. I bumped into a chap who was with the resistance. He sent out messages, and they got me across France to a waiting boat."
Jeremy looked from Pamela's face to Ben's.
"Quite an adventure," Ben said. "Not one I'd care to repeat," Jeremy said. "But fear is a great motivator. I knew if they caught me, they'd shoot me."
"So what will you do now? Will you go back to flying?" Ben asked.
"I've been given a desk job until I'm deemed fit to fly again," Jeremy said. "The bullet damaged the muscles in my right arm, and I'm a bag of skin and bones. I need building up first, but that will happen rapidly here. Mother is spoiling me, as you can imagine, and Mrs. Treadwell is a wonderful cook. My God, how I dreamed of meals like this when we got our slice of black bread and watery soup."
He stared past them, out of the windows.
"I suppose I can't be too impatient to get back to work. It will take a while. I can't help thinking about those other fellows, the ones who broke out of the Stalag with me, all mown down in a hail of bullets, and their families wondering how they are doing, not knowing they are dead."
He turned back with an attempt at a bright smile.
"But here I am, exactly where I dreamed of being. And look at you, Pamma. God, you're lovelier than I remembered, more grown up."
"I am 2 years older," Pamma said, "and I've had my 21st, so I am officially an adult now."
Ben shifted uneasily at the long glance that passed between them.
"I should go and leave you two in peace," he said. "Would you, old chap?"
Jeremy said.
I'm dying to kiss her, you know.
Of course, Ben answered, trying to keep his voice light. I'll come and visit you again soon.
Do. That would be splendid. I'm anxious to hear what you've been doing, anxious to get back to normality. The last year has been like a bad dream, and now I've woken up. I've been doing nothing thrilling, I'm afraid, Ben said. Good to have you home again.
Ben, you don't have to... Pamela called after him, but he was already heading back into the darkness of the room beyond. He let himself out. Jeremy looked at Pamma and eased over to make room next to himself on the chaise longue.
"Come here, you delectable creature," he said.
"Which is your bad shoulder?" Pamela asked as she sat beside him. "I don't want to risk hurting you."
"All patched up and healing nicely, thank you," he said.
"Here."
He slipped his arm around her neck and pulled her toward him. "God, I've dreamed of this moment," he said. His kiss was hard and demanding, his lips crushing against hers so fiercely that she almost cried out in pain. His tongue thrust into her mouth, and his hand fumbled with the buttons of her blouse. One of them broke off with his persistent tugging and went bouncing across the tiled floor. His hand forced its way inside her blouse, his fingers worming inside her brassiere to cup her breast. As she felt his fingers on her warm flesh, seeking her nipple, she pulled her face away from him.
"Jeremy, not here. Anyone can see us," she laughed nervously.
"I'm as anxious as you are to pick up where we left off, but..."
He was still looking at her hungrily.
"The only people who might see are working for my father, and they are paid well to keep their mouths shut." She sat up.
"I'm sorry. It's a bit too much too soon, Jeremy. I'm so thrilled to see you again, but we had never gone this far before, had we? And it's been so long."
"Damn it, Pamma," he said. "I'm only human, you know. Do you know how many times I've dreamed of doing this while I was in that wretched hellhole?"
"I'm sorry. You caught me by surprise, that's all."
"Have to learn to control myself, won't I? Behave like the good old chap again." He gave her a wicked grin. "As soon as I'm not confined to this chair, I'm going to whisk you away. We'll run off together."
"Elope, you mean? To Gretna Green?"
Pamela asked, not quite sure whether to be excited or scared. Jeremy looked amused. "My dear sweet girl, you really still are a romantic innocent, aren't you? Who can think of getting married with a war on? I want to whisk you up to a discreet hotel in London. I want to go to bed with you."
"Oh,"
Pamela felt her cheeks burning. "As you just said, my darling, you are now an adult." His eyes were teasing her. "Or is there someone else I don't know about? I'd understand if there was. I've been gone a long time. And I don't suppose you even knew whether I was alive or dead."
"There's nobody else, Jeremy," she said. "There's only you. There has only ever been you."
He looked pleased. "Well, that's all right then." She took a deep breath before asking,
"I gather my little sister has been coming to visit."
"She has. Entertaining little kid, isn't she? Quite amusing." Pamela felt a wave of relief. As Ben came out of the front door, a Rolls-Royce was pulling up. The driver's door opened, and Sir William Prescott himself climbed out, brushing down his suit jacket in case it had picked up any creases during the drive. He always looked immaculate, perfectly groomed, hair with the requisite amount of grey in it, Savile Row tailored suit. There had been a rumour at one time, before the war started, that he was considering running for Parliament. But the war had put a stop to such aspirations, if indeed they were any more than a rumour. He walked around the car and opened the passenger side door. While Ben was considering that in the days before the war a footman would have come running out to do this, Lady Prescott emerged. She was always elegant, too, but in a country sort of way, where Sir William's image said clearly, City, High Finance, Banking. His wife's spoke more of growing prize roses for the flower show, of church bazaars and charity events. It was she who noticed Ben first. Her face broke into a beautiful smile.
Ben, how absolutely lovely to see you. We didn't know you were coming down. You've heard about Jeremy, then? Isn't it splendid? There were times when I never thought I'd see him again. And then we got the telegram, like a miracle.
Sir William extended his hand.
Good to see you, young Cresswell. How are you? Are they keeping you busy?
Busy enough, sir. How are you?
Up to our eyes, old boy, he said, trying to put a deal with the Yanks in place. They might want to stay out of the war this time, but we need their help financially. Churchill's the only one who can persuade them. If we don't get their money, we're sunk.
The Americans are going to give us money. Sir William gave a short, brittle laugh.
Lend, my boy, lend. And at a pretty favourable rate to them, too. But we desperately need help. Money and equipment, all to be repaid if we ever win this damned war.
Lady Prescott was less interested in the American lease-lend deal.
You've been to see Jeremy, have you? He's so painfully thin. I can't imagine how he survived all those weeks, making his way through hostile territory. Sometimes not eating for days, he said, and with that horrible infected wound. How does he seem to you?
Clearly on the mend, Ben said, remembering the smouldering look he was giving Pamela. He was tempted not to mention her presence, and thus let them be caught, but instead he cleared his throat.
Pamela is in with him now. Pamela? How lovely!
Lady Prescott beamed.
I expect her mother telephoned her with the news, and she came straight down. How is she doing? We've certainly missed her.
Doing well, Ben said. Looks a little tired, but we're all working too many hours with night shifts and fire-watching duty.
Doing your bit, that's what matters, Sir William said heartily.
Are you here for long, Ben? Lady Prescott asked.
Not sure. A week, maybe.
We must have you to dinner before you go back. It's been too long since we've had a dinner party. I promised Lord Westrum's lot, too, and your father, of course.
You're very kind, Ben nodded solemnly. I should be getting back.
Good to see you, my boy,
Sir William reiterated, and took his wife's arm as they went into the house. Ben stomped home to the vicarage, fighting back his growing anger. He should never have gone in the first place. Jeremy and Pamela obviously hadn't wanted him there, couldn't wait to get rid of him. And to see the way they looked at each other. Ben blinked to shut out the memory.
You're a fool, he said to himself. If you'd wanted her, you should have made your move while he was missing and presumed dead. You could have comforted and reassured her, and she might have come to rely on you, and then maybe...
He shut off this thought because he knew he would never have betrayed Jeremy. Pamela might have been the one he yearned for, but Jeremy was his friend, and now he supposed they'd marry and live happily ever after. He made the decision to put Pamela from his thoughts once and for all, and to get on with his life.
Chapter 13 All Saints Vicarage, Elmsley, May 1941. The Reverend Cresswell was sitting in his study, staring blankly out of the window where a blackbird was singing on the wicker fence. He was roused from his trance when Ben knocked politely and came into the room.
"Sorry to disturb you, Father," he said.
"What's that, my boy?" "Oh, not at all, not at all. Trying to come up with a theme for Sunday's sermon," he sighed. "So difficult these days. You can't preach hell-fire any more. They all know about hell only too well, so it has to be encouraging and uplifting." But how can you tell them that God is on our side when the Germans are told the same thing?
I'm thinking Daniel in the lion's den, trusting God against all odds. What do you think?
Ben nodded. Since he'd gone off to Oxford, he had found it harder and harder to believe in his father's version of God. Of course, he never told the old man, but since the accident and then the outbreak of war, he had begun to wonder whether God existed at all.
"Do you still have an ordnance survey map of the area?"
"Should have, somewhere. Try the second drawer in that bureau." He watched as Ben opened the drawer and found it crammed full of papers.
"Planning to do some walking along the footpaths while you're here?"
"I may." Ben dumped the tangled mess of papers on the table.
"Really, Father, these need sorting out. Do you want me to do it for you while I'm home?"
"Thank you. I'd appreciate that," Reverend Cresswell said.
"I never seem to have the time to get around to it. Of course, Mrs. Finch would love to get her hands on my study, but it's strictly out of bounds, except that I allow her to run the carpet sweeper over the floor. If I let her have her way, she'd have everything in the room stacked neatly and alphabetically, and I wouldn't be able to find a thing."
Ben smiled. He put aside a pamphlet on preparing for confirmation, one for last year's church fete, a programme for Gilbert and Sullivan's at the doily cart, and sundry letters before he unearthed a map of France, one of Switzerland, and then the one he wanted.
"Ah, good. Here it is," he said. "I'll start sorting this stuff for you later, but I need to borrow this now, if you don't mind."
"If you're thinking of walking, check with me first. You may find some changes. New people have bought the old Oast House beyond Broadbent's farm. Arty types from London, one gathers. Needless to say, they haven't been near the church." He smiled. "But I hear that they've tried to block the footpath from going through their grounds. People have told them that they can't do it. Old right-of-way from the village to Hildenborough, but I don't think it's had much effect. And in wartime, nobody is going to bother with a court case."
"I'm not worried, Father," Ben said. "Plenty of other places to walk.
So have you met the new people yet?"
"Can't say I have. I gather they frequent the pub occasionally. Two men from London, one of them a well-known artist. Dr. Sinclair said he'd been for sherry with them, and the paintings were frightful. All red and black daubs, he said. One of them is Danish, Hansen, but he's not the famous one. Some sort of Russian name. Stravinsky? Something like that."
While his father spoke, Ben spread out the map on a table. He took a ruler and rotated it in a 5-mile radius. There was a broad area of flatland toward Tunbridge, lots of fields to land in. So if the parachutist had really chosen Lord Westerham's field, then, realistically, his contact had to be within walking distance. That meant the Farley estate, the village cottages, the bigger houses on the green, his father's vicarage, Dr. Sinclair, Miss Hamilton's, Colonel Huntley's. A couple of farms came within this radius, Highcroft's and Broadbent's, and then Nethercote, the Prescott's estate, a 1/2 mile from the village. That was it. Ben sighed. He'd known the people in the village all his life, unless there were any recent arrivals apart from the Oast House men. And the Colonel and Nethercote and Farley, they were all as true blue and English as you come. Nobody would want to aid the Germans. He came to the conclusion that they had got it wrong. The man who fell was not a spy trying to pass a message to a contact. He had to be an accident, a man who fell from a plane by mistake in the wrong place. But he'd been commissioned to investigate by a powerful and senior man, so he had to carry out the assignment and do it well. He folded up the map again. "I'll keep this for the moment, if you don't mind." Reverend Cresswell looked up and nodded.
"What? Oh, no, by all means, keep it." He looked at his son. "So why are you home?"
"Why, aren't you glad to see me?"
"Of course. But I just wondered whether that leg of yours was proving too much of a hindrance, and you weren't really able to...
You're asking whether they kicked me out from a desk job in wartime?" Ben's voice was sharp.
Really, Father, in spite of what anyone may think, I am not a poor cripple. I can walk perfectly well. Pamela and I walked from the station with suitcases. I just have a blasted knee that won't bend, that's all. So don't sign me up as a wicket-keeper if we have a village cricket match. His father looked shocked at the outburst. I'm sorry, Benjamin. I really didn't mean to upset you. I just wondered when you arrived home out of the blue, and one hears that nobody is getting any sort of leave these days. Ben took a deep breath, his distaste of what he had to say already showing on his face. As a matter of fact, I was told I had been overdoing it and needed a few days off. All those night shifts can take a toll, you know, and fire-watching duty when one isn't working. You're still in central London? Seen a lot of bombing? Quite a bit. You're in one of the ministries, aren't you? That's right. Interesting work. Ben smiled now. Father, there's a war on. Even if I'm doing the most boring job in the world, I'm not allowed to tell you about it. I understand, his father said. Well, it's good to have you home, my boy. Make the most of your time here. Enjoy Mrs. Finch's cooking. Get some fresh air. I intend to. Thanks. As he was about to walk from the room, his father said, And Lady Pamela, what's she doing home? Same as me, I should think, he said. Working too many long night shifts. They don't expect girls to do work all night, do they? Everybody has to work all the time, Ben said. But surely they don't need things like filing done at night. Where did you say she works? I didn't. But it's a government department, and they've been moved out of London. Bright girl, Lady Pamela. First-class brain, Reverend Cresswell said. She'd have done well at Oxford. I tried to tell her father, but he wouldn't hear of it. In his mind, one marries off a daughter at the first opportunity, and then is free of all obligations toward her. Positively medieval. The word reminded Ben of his other sphere of inquiry. That reminds me, Father. You're a history buff. 1461. What happened that year? Anything significant? Reverend Cresswell stared past Ben out the window, where a large draft horse was pulling a cart full of manure. 1461, you say? Wars of the Roses, wasn't it? Wars of the Roses, Ben tried to remember the history lessons at Tunbridge School. There had been endless repetitions of dates and battles that he retained in his head until the exam was passed, then he happily forgot. The House of Lancaster versus the House of York, and York won, eventually. Henry VI, with his bouts of insanity, was deposed by Edward IV in 1461, if I remember correctly. That's right. There were two bloody battles, one on the Welsh border at Mortimer's Cross, and the other up in Yorkshire. Battle of Towton, one of the bloodiest battles ever. Scores of men killed, and Edward emerged victorious. Ben was taking this information one step further. And would you happen to know whether either was fought on terrain with a steep hillside behind it? I have no idea, Reverend Cresswell sounded surprised. I didn't know you were interested in battles, at least not ancient ones. A question I was asked at work, he said. I get a lot of strange questions in the reference department. Well, the Welsh marches are quite hilly, aren't they? And Yorkshire. You have the dales and the moors, but both are more gentle slopes, if I recall correctly, from rambling up there in my student days. Thank you, Ben smiled at his father. You've been very helpful. It's good to have a father who is a fount of knowledge. Oh, I wouldn't say that. The vicar coughed in an embarrassed sort of way. I've always enjoyed history, as you know, and I like to read. Not much for the wireless, and the winter evenings can seem very long and lonely, so one reads. Ben looked at his father with compassion.
all those years alone since his mother died, and yet he had happily sent his son off to boarding school, knowing it would be the right thing to do if his son wanted to get ahead.
"You don't happen to have an ordnance survey map of the whole of Britain, do you?" he asked.
"I'm afraid not. I expect they have one in the library in Sevenoaks or Tunbridge." He looked at Ben with interest.
"I'm glad you're keen on taking exercise. Build up the muscles, that's the ticket."
"Actually, I was thinking more of those battles. Mortimer's Cross, Towton."
"I'm surprised that ancient battles are of interest in the middle of a modern war," Reverend Cresswell said. "But I expect you have your reasons. Good to have something to work on and keep the mind busy. And I should be getting back to my sermon."
He turned back to his open Bible. Ben took the map and went through to the drawing room. He spread the map on a low table and looked at it again. Then he opened the little notebook he carried in his breast pocket and took out his fountain pen. "Osthaus people," he wrote. "Check village for newcomers. Then map for Mortimer's Cross and Towton." Although how two ancient battles could possibly be connected to a modern war, he found hard to imagine. Maybe something else happened in 1461, a smaller battle, a critical turning of the tide in the Wars of the Roses. He'd need to go to the library, or to his old school in Tunbridge, and see if they had any books on the subject. He realized he was rather looking forward to the research aspect, rather like a puzzle. Chapter 14. Farley Place, Kent, May 1941. The Rolls-Royce crunched over the gravel drive as it approached Farley Place. Pamela was glad she had accepted Sir William's offer to run her home. She realized she was out of practice for the long walks that country living entailed. Also, she had to admit that she was glad when Jeremy's parents came in to interrupt them. His sudden fierce passion had alarmed her. She certainly could understand it after being locked up all that time, but she had found his advances overwhelming. She was not completely naive. She had repelled young men's advances at debutante balls. She'd had to fight off a couple in taxis. But she had always been conscious that she was waiting for Jeremy, saving herself for him. Now his frank admission that he wanted to take her to bed had unsettled her. Of course, she wanted him to make love to her, but her fantasy had always pictured the long white dress, the flowing veil, and then the honeymoon at a lovely villa in Italy, where he'd take her into his arms and whisper, "Alone at last, my darling."
"How did you get here?"
Sir William had asked when they pulled out of Nethercote's driveway onto the country lane.
"I walked with Ben," she said. "Can you believe it? We came from London on the same train. Pure coincidence."
"Good chap, young Cresswell,"
Sir William said.
"I can't help feeling a bit sorry for him, stuck being a pen pusher and missing all the fun."
"Do you really think it is fun?" Pamela asked. "For those who are actually fighting?"
"At least they know they are doing something worthwhile, defending their country. What could be more valuable than that? A chance to prove you've got what it takes. And my son robbed him of that chance. Showing off as usual. Taking risks. It's in his nature, I'm afraid. Let's hope this latest escapade has knocked some sense into him."
They had reached the tall brick wall that enclosed the Farley estate. They turned in at the gateway between the stone pillars topped with lions. Pamela looked out the window at the dear, familiar surroundings. The chestnuts were in full flower with their white candles. The flower beds had been allowed to run wild, however. The lawns were certainly not as well manicured as at Nethercote. She leaned forward in her seat, anxious to get her first glimpse of the house. but as they approached, they were met by a procession of army lorries driving toward them, the convoy cutting off her view of Farley and reminding her abruptly that it didn't really belong to the Sutton family at the moment.
"I hope these blighters aren't messing up the place too badly,"
Sir William said, as the first of the lorries passed them.
"Pa hasn't complained, so I suppose it must be all right so far."
"One hears horror stories," Sir William said. "Using the ancestors..."